Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Why do newsreaders talk like this?
Why do journalists spell lead wrong?
And what is a knobbly monster?
We've got the scoop on news exclusive jargon, journalism cliches, and more. Stay tuned on Another Words Unraveled.
Welcome to Another Words Unraveled. This is Rob Watts reporting live from Berlin.
And this is Jess Zafaris on location in rural Connecticut.
Very good. Right, so this is an episode about journalism, the words associated with it and the words used by journalists. I feel right up top, we should just point out that we are somewhat experienced in this field because I think it's relevant, right?
I, for example, have worked at many different news organizations, the ABC affiliate in Denver for TV, but mostly in print at the Denver Business Journal. I was the editor of several magazines, and I teach a magazine course at Emerson.
Yeah, so where Jess has got print nailed down, I've got a career history in broadcast journalism. Actually, I have a master's in broadcast journalism, believe it or not. And I spent 10 years at the BBC and another 5 years working in television here in Germany. I've written an awful lot of news scripts down the years, thousands of them, quite literally. I've also had 1,000 chips on my shoulder about journalistic cliches, that a few of which I expect I will not be able to refrain from mentioning during the course of this episode as we take a trip to Fleet Street.
Or the Fourth Estate is what we're visiting over here.
Yeah, so why is it called the Fourth Estate?
Hang on, I've got that here. By the way, I didn't notice. I don't know if I made the connection that we both have masters in journalism. I wonder if this is like, is there a pipeline from journalism master's degrees to etymology?
There is a thing about working with words day in, day out, and the correct deployment of them that does lead you to look, okay, so how has this word been used down the centuries? And that inevitably takes you further back, closer to the word's origins, I suppose. So it's maybe not so strange.
You learn in J school, or when you were learning journalism as a practice, you learn how to identify a reliable source, which I think is critical. Like, there is so much misinformation. Being able to quickly make a judgment on the credibility of a source is a skill in both of these realms.
Yeah, and just the general practice of double sourcing as well, which is, you know, so many internet sources fall down on, you know, just finding two reputable sources.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Fourth Estate, the term the Fourth Estate or Fourth Power refers to the press and news media in their capacity. The other three estates are the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners. So this is originally a British thing.
Oh.
The OED is unsure, but traces it without confirmation to Edmund Burke, who may have used it in a British parliamentary debate in 1771 on the opening up of press reporting of the House of Commons.
And I referred to Fleet Street, which was just a street in London where there were a lot of print houses and a lot of journalistic offices. There are many fewer now, but, you know, even in my lifetime, it was the hub of British print journalism.
It is kind of amazing how many journalistic terms have kind of entered common parlance. I'm not sure they're entirely divorced from it, but one of the more glaring examples is the way we attach gate onto any scandal as a result of reporting on the Watergate scandal. Fun rebracketing.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's rebracketing, right? Where you take part of a word and you stick it on the end of other ones, even though it's not, it doesn't technically make any sense.
Right.
Gate. I mean, gate just means street in Watergate. We use it to mean any scandal. In fact, you can even refer to a scandal as just a gate, which is remarkable, really.
Our gate. People will regularly use terms like on the record and off the record and things like that all the time. These infuse. I'm not sure everyone uses on background as much, though, in real life.
What's on background? Is that when you ask some questions that are off the record, I suppose?
Not off the record. It means you can use the information, but you cannot cite the source.
We have something in Britain called Chatham House Rules, which is a very similar idea. They'll tell you this, but Chatham House Rules, don't say who told you.
Corporate America has stolen that term too for like meetings where you can get together with executives and share information without attributing it to the other business.
Right, yeah. Chatham House is a place in London, by the way.
So where should we dive in here on news? Should we talk about perhaps different types of publications?
Yeah, let's talk about those. Let's talk about different types of newspaper. In Britain, we used to divide newspapers up into tabloids and broadsheets, right? And people still talk in these terms. I think only one of the broadsheets is still technically a broadsheet. They've all changed to a different format of paper now called a Berliner, right? Which is much smaller. But you used to have these gigantic newspapers, right? They were humongous. And they were called broadsheets. But they also happen to be generally the papers of record, the sort of more reputable newspapers, I would say, and then the tabloid newspapers, which were smaller, easier to hold, were also the sort of tattlers, the peddlers of the more salacious stories.
And the names here are just referring to the size. It's broadsheet because it's larger format. And that's also where we get above the fold, which refers to the top half of the broadsheet front page, what's visible when the paper is folded on a stand, which is now also used in web design and whatnot. And then tabloid was originally just a smaller size newspaper, usually 11 by 17, and often pejoratively is also used to imply sensationalism, but it really was just the size at first. And it is named after a trademark name for a small tablet of medicine for like compressed or concentrated drugs. It was a hybrid form, ostensibly from tablet plus the Greek suffix oid, so like a shaped tablet or tablet shaped, but it's said to be specifically a portmanteau of tablet and alkaloid for that original drug. So capital tabloid.
And now we have tabloides, which is tacking on an extra element to the end of the word tabloid. Is tabloides, is this a thing that you're aware of from reporting in the United States? Because I tend to think of American newspapers as being a little less sensationalist than British ones. Maybe I'm being naive.
We have tabloids, certainly. There's, I would say, more of a gravitas to a lot of American reporting in newspaper formats. I know it's the other way around, for it's more on TV, your side of the pond. But we also have tabloids too. Like we also got rags, you know.
Well, tabloides refers to the unusual word choices that you find only in tabloid newspapers, particularly on their front pages, right? And it's usually driven by the need to save space. So for example, British newspapers on their front pages will often not use the word child. They'll use the word tot instead. Actually, to be honest, this one's dying out a little bit, but you know, they will use the word romp, right? Instead of referring to having sex, for example, they'll refer to a prisoner as a lag. They'll say a lag on the run, and they'll refer to experts as boffins. I'm not quite sure why they do that, because it isn't any shorter. But also, you know, it's never an investigation. It's always a probe. It's never an argument. It's always a row. People don't get criticized. They get blasted or slammed or rapped, you know, and you don't have managers and executives, you have chiefs and bosses. This is all tabloides. It's also journalese. You see it much more widely than that.
Also, a lot of this is copy fitting, right? If you want to have a giant headline across the top of your newspaper, then it has to be able to fit. Or if you want to fit it in a little column or whatever else, which reminds me of one of my favorite topics, which is crash blossoms. Have you heard of a crash blossom?
No, I have not. What's a crash blossom?
You have seen a crash blossom, even okay. If you don't know the name. So a crash blossom happens when spacing restrictions and character counts result in word and punctuation choices that make the headline ambiguous or nonsensical. And they're named after a 2009 headline in the newspaper Japan Today, "Violinist linked to JAL crash blossoms." Just to rephrase that so you can understand it, violinist linked to JAL crash blossoms. So a violinist who was linked to a Japan Airlines plane crash is enjoying a successful career. And then more of these are like missing woman remains found. And which I mean,
that's
some
so
of these
sad. Like, laughing at it. Right. Oh, don't laugh. That's just full on sad.
And then, here's one of my favorites is British left waffles on Falklands, which is the left wing British leaders are waffling or flip flopping on their position around the Falkland Islands.
Just left treats for the local ones as they departed.
Another one, McDonald's fries the holy grail for potato farmers, which is McDonald's fries are the holy grail or a huge sales opportunity for potato farmers.
And these are crash blossoms. I love these. These are so much fun.
They're fun.
Can I counter with a term that you might not have heard of then?
Oh, yeah.
Are you aware of what a knobbly monster is?
No, but it sounds like the most British thing I've ever heard.
Well, so it comes from, much like crash blossoms, a specific instance. There's a big pressure when writing, either for print or for television or radio or whatever, to avoid repetition. Journalists will go to great lengths to find synonyms for whatever it is that they want to refer to twice in short succession, right? As, you know, like a really common, simple one of these is, journalists will constantly use the word blaze as the second reference to a fire. When
a fire,
really it would make far more sense to just say fire again. No one calls a fire a blaze.
Conflagration.
But really, they will resort to this sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Just to avoid saying fire twice, because it's received wisdom that it's bad writing to use the same word twice in quick succession. Certainly not in the same sentence, but even in consecutive sentences. Just thought as bad form. In the effort to avoid this repetition, at its most extreme, you get something called a knobbly monster. And it is so called because this was an infamous second reference to a crocodile.
Because there aren't any, like, what are you going to say, a river lizard?
Exactly. So they could have said the green scaly reptile or something like that. But instead they went for knobbly monsters. And there are so many of these that are really, really funny. I came across a good one the other day, just on reporting of, you know, President Trump was in Scotland to visit his golf course. No, he was there on some sort of diplomatic mission, but he did just so happen to visit his golf course. And there's an article about the security at the golf course describing this new technology that they're using there called Daleks, right? And the quote is, "The Daleks, security devices that resemble Doctor Who's croaky-voiced enemies, have been set up to deter intruders."
Croaky-voiced enemies.
The knobbly monsters there is Doctor Who's croaky-voiced enemies, which is joyous. There's a
not
really
like
great one.
Not like robotic enemies, not like...
And it, you know, that one is almost beautiful, right? And there's definitely some intentional creativity going on here, because there's a very rich community collecting these things online. If you search for knobbly monsters, there's some great Twitter accounts, and I think knobbly monsters is a Twitter account or X account. And there's another one called Second Mentions where you get very similar stuff. But for example, down the years, advent calendars have been referred to as the festive time markers, badgers as the monochrome plague spreaders, beavers as the furry tree munchers, and Darth Vader as the heavy breathing Jedi turncoat.
Oh my God. Heavy breathing. I mean, it's not wrong, but
yeah, it's good.
At least
good.
They didn't go with wheezing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, with a lot of this repetition is simply avoided by using the word it or they. You don't actually have to refer to the same person twice. You say, a fire broke out at the city secondary school yesterday. The blaze is one of the worst ever to hit the region. You know, you could just say it was one of the worst ever to hit the region, and that gets you out of it. But for some reason, we journalists will go to great lengths to find an alternative way of expressing that same word.
Sometimes it is also a function of not writing the same story over and over again. Like I have edited and written a good amount of stories about like programmatic advertising and upfronts and things that happen every year. The Super Bowl, I've written a lot of Super Bowl stories. You just get tired of saying like the ad over and over and over again. Like so we've got like the big game spot alterations on that. And it's sometimes it's a function of not just like I've written 10 of these and I don't need to say the same thing four more times.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, when writing about word origins, Jess, as we often do, I mean, how many different words for word can you think of? Because otherwise you just find yourself saying word over right. and over and over again, right? Terms.
Book titles, coming up with a book title and a subtitle for your book, it's difficult to not say word in both of them. I have a book that I just finished coming out next year called Into the Words. And for the subtitle, I ended up I got stuck for a little while because I didn't know how to not say like words for animals and plants. Like,
yeah, you have to resort to terms or something like that, mm-hmm. right?
I went with an etymologist's field guide to natural animals, plants, and the natural world.
Oh, well, I mean, that's just elegant, Jess. That's very nice. That's just nice writing.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Next, I would love to talk about magazines. That's one of my favorite topics because I, do this a lot.
Yeah, you miss magazine.
I have worked in magazines for like most of my career. And the word magazine is Arabic in origin. It means storehouse or depot. Mm. And it was altered via Italian and Middle French, magasin, which this makes it a false friend. You've heard of these, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Where a word that comes from the same source means two different things in different languages. In French, magasin still means storehouse or store, correct?
It's a shop. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the basic word for a shop is a magasin.
So in English, magazine first appeared in the 1580s to describe a military storehouse for ammunition and supplies, later extended to the thing that holds the ammo on the weapon itself. And the gentleman's magazine was among the first to apply this term to printed miscellany, trying to be a bit cute with the storehouse and military terminology. Magazine essentially became, as a result of that, shorthand for any periodical publication.
Right.
It's a storehouse of information, you might say.
Oh, that's nice. So that's an easy way to draw the link between the magazine clip or whatever that, you know, you're carrying your bullets around with and the magazine that you might be reading while you're waiting for your target in the car.
Although the Gentleman's Magazine was the first of what we would call a magazine today, there were periodicals and things at the time, usually like shorter form pamphlets and things. And a lot of them appealed to both before and after the Gentleman's Magazine to women because they would be a little less hard news and a little more like interesting diversions. So the Gentleman's Magazine is being a little bit masculine with its name, but then it was extended to everything else. Another cool one is Gazette.
Yeah, there's something Italian going on with Gazette, right?
There is. In fact, it's money. It's the Italian Gazetta is a Venetian coin, which was the price of an early newspaper in Venice.
Like a penny dreadful.
Yeah,
was a publication that cost a penny. A Gazette cost a Gazeta.
I think this one's probably pretty obvious, but I don't know if everyone has thought through it. The fact that a journal is a daily. It is from the French for daily.
Yeah, it is. Someone actually, you know, when we did our episode about time, someone made the comment that we haven't incorporated the word jour from French into English, but actually we have. It is in
journal.
A journalist is someone who writes daily, right? Like a journal is something you write in daily.
It is cognate with the word diurnal, which we borrowed from Latin. The French journal is from the Latin diurnalis, and then originally from just the word for day in Latin.
Oh, right.
Right?
Just
the D shifted to the J.
Because it seems like diurnal should mean, well, we know it doesn't. It means daily, right? But it feels like it should mean, it should have something to do with two.
But it's just daily.
Can I talk a little bit about some journalistic cliches or journalistic formulations, you know, ways of writing that you only get in news reporting?
Listen, I know we have addressed this before, but I love that you use journalistic cliches considering the source of cliche and like printing. Anyway, but yes, let's do it.
Well, I mean, I was thinking, and this is something that whenever I was writing news scripts, I would have on my mind all the time, was to avoid using certain set phrases or constructions that are very common in news, but aren't true to natural speech. A good one of these is the way that you'll see in news stories, the phrase set to be instead of will used a lot. Here's one. Eurovision 2026 host city is set to be announced on August the 20th. I mean, it sounds okay, right? But it's
but
not
people
how
don't say
people
that.
Talk. No, you'd say it's going to happen, right? If it is going to happen, you just say it's going to happen. If you're not sure if it's going to happen, you say might be or is, you know, scheduled to be. And set to be is a very journalistic way of putting it. When something's going up, it's always on the rise. You ever notice that? And here's one that journalists use all the time when they want to bring two events together, but either there isn't an obvious, genuine link between them or they just don't have the time to explain it. They will say, this comes as, or the news comes as. Are you aware of this one? Here's an example. This is from CBS News. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is blasting US efforts to provide more weapons to Israel for its war against Hamas in Gaza. This comes as more organizations accuse Israel of carrying out genocide. Okay, it's a very dark story, a very dark example to use, but the this comes as there suggests a causal link between those two things without saying that there is a causal link between those two things. And it's quite, I don't want to call journalists sneaky. You know, they're very valuable. I consider myself one.
It is intentional. I don't think it's being sneaky. I think it's covering your ass a little bit in the same way that allegedly does. Like one of the words you do have to repeat over and over again is allegedly or according to the police report or according to the affidavit. When working in TV news, man, every time we got in a new report on something local that had happened, it was allegedly. And you have to, because if the person hasn't been charged, you more or less end up accusing them of the crime that they're being arrested for.
Attribution is incredibly important. The word allegedly is not the cure-all legally that we sometimes like to think it is. It certainly isn't in British law anyway, which is generally a little bit more restricted. Like American law is very,
really hardcore on press.
Yeah, really hardcore on press freedom. So it does let you get away with a lot more. But also there's stuff like use of the passive voice, you know, it is being reported, for example, or it's understood.
This happens in criminal stories too, as well. Like when a crime is committed, it's a person was found dead. The woman was hit with the brick, you know. Sorry, I'm getting really violent here.
nice choice. Just straight off the top of your head.
Right. But you can't say like a person did that because they haven't been charged with that crime.
Yeah, you're right. But it's generally seen as bad form to use the passive voice if you can avoid it, isn't it? I mean, that's just one of those things for general writing. If you can attribute something to someone, you should. And it's definitely used in PR to, you know, avoid apportioning blame or you know, flagging up your own blame if you use the passive voice.
Exciting. Were there any other cliches that you wanted to cover?
There's one that I've noticed in US newscasters that I haven't heard anywhere else. There is a construction, a use of the gerund that only exists in newscasting in the United States. Let me give you an example, right? Actually, I'm going to play you an example.
Good morning, America. Air quality alerts. Smoke from hundreds of Canadian wildfires affecting major American cities and now moving east. Who's at risk and what sensitive groups need to know? Plus, breaking overnight, an earthquake rattling parts of the East Coast.
Sweeping new tariffs set to take effect this week. American businesses and consumers bracing for the impact. The predictions on what you may be spending thousands of dollars more on this year.
So did you notice how many ing words there were in there? And it was completely unnatural. For example, plus breaking overnight, an earthquake rattling parts of the East Coast. I mean, you know, normal construction would be an earthquake is or has is rattling or has rattled, right? But I don't know if it's to sort of introduce an immediacy where there isn't one otherwise. Sweeping new tariffs set to take effect this week. American businesses and consumers bracing for the impact is completely ungrammatical, but we're used to it. It's part of the grammar of news broadcasting. And it's a bit like those unusual constructions in the print headlines. You get away with certain stuff like that.
I think it's a vestige, like a transferred vestige of like character count and column width.
Yeah, I think so. And it's peculiar to see words like row getting used a lot in broadcast journalism when they're only in the lexicon in the way that they are to save column inches. But nevertheless, you know, they get used. And it's because, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a rant here.
Okay.
It's because a lot of the time, news broadcasters are putting on a news broadcaster voice. And literally, sometimes the news broadcaster usually talks like this, just putting slightly too long a pause. And that is someone sort of faking it until they make it, usually. It's someone that's trying to sound like a newscaster, because really what you want to end up doing is sound like a normal person talking. That's the ultimate goal of, you know, good writing and good presentation. And one of the things I found really difficult, because occasionally I would be asked to try and train a new news reader, because I used to read the news on the radio, and you know, I did it for enough years that they would occasionally ask me to train someone else up on it. And one of the hardest things was to sort of detrain them from this voice that they've learned from watching the TV news or listening to the radio. And it's the newscaster voice. And there's a British one, definitely. There's an American one. And they've got them all over the world. And you'll notice it. It's bizarre. It's intonation that is deployed. You will notice that the very best people, the people that really connect with you, they don't use it.
I think it's about speed, too. Like, say, if you're reading a teleprompter, it helps you space out your words more easily so that you can keep up with it. Because we accelerate and decelerate our phrasing when we are speaking in more common parlance.
You know, I think that's very fair, actually. And to be charitable to people who are reading off a teleprompter, something that they haven't written themselves, I can understand why the speech can sometimes seem a little bit stilted. And also occasionally the intonation won't fit with the direction of the sentence because they don't know where it's going.
Rob, you're stressing me out.
very genuine phenomenon.
Let's see. Any other cliches off the top of your head?
You know, you get sort of couplets that only appear together or appear together in journalistic writing more frequently than they do in just normal everyday speech. For example, you know, crisis talks. You know, people don't talk about having crisis.
Right. We're having a crisis talk right now.
You might have a crisis meeting, but basically, you know, just any sort of meeting where there is something bad going on and they've got to discuss it becomes crisis talks. Reports are always damning. Debates are always heated. You know, deals come at the 11th hour. And people go on charm offensives. These are phrases that you don't generally hear that often outside of particularly political reporting from the television or from newspapers.
It's an extension of the same thing we were talking about earlier, where you need to find another way of referring back to something else where without using just a pronoun. It's in the same energy as like legalese has those anaphoric adverbs like herein and therein. And it strikes me as like an easy way to express what's happening in a condensed collocative way.
Yeah, you're right. There's a shorthand to it, right? So people know when you're talking about crisis talks, the listener or the reader goes,
right,
so there's some talks, they're doing this. It is a handy shorthand, but it's dreadfully uncreative.
Could we talk a little bit about jargon, like newsroom jargon?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. I think print newsrooms are particularly rich in this sort of stuff because of the, you know, the centuries long legacy they've got.
I mean, we also have a lot of like written evidence for it dating back to, you know, X years because we have like edited sheets before something goes to print. But like, for example, we've got these little spelling oddities like lead and head and deck and TK. Have you used these in other instances before?
I have only used lead as in bury the lead.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the odd spelling of lead there that comes about purely for the sake of having an alternative spelling of the word lead, which I think is kind of amazing.
It's L-E-D-E, and this is the one that comes up. If you say bury the lead, you are referring to the newsroom sense of it, and it is a deliberate respelling of lead, L-E-A-D, meant to distinguish the opening paragraph of a story from the metal lead and leading used in typesetting, which is the vertical space between lines of text, usually measured from like baseline to baseline. We've talked about this in our typography and printing episode, but a lead could also refer to a slug or a piece of spacing material, like the actual piece of metal, but that could also be a slug too. Like in the realm of hot type printing, a slug was also a single line of cast metal type, perhaps on the notion that an unformed one of those looks a little bit like a slug.
And slug gets used quite widely in journalism as well to be like a one or two word phrase that's used as a shorthand for a story. So you might have US elects, for example, for all stories that are about the US election or whatever. And that sometimes gets referred to as the slug.
Right. A slug is a little short label or code for a story that's in production and it started in print. But now you'll see, if you've ever used a CMS to publish a story, you'll see the article's URL handle has a little like a slug on it too. So you can keep track of the story and so that the URL doesn't change later.
I think if we were creating that phenomenon today, we'd call it a tag.
And there's probably a tie here with the slug to like a bullet also being a lead bullet also being called a slug here. We also spell the word head funny. It's H-E-D. It's shorter because it's easy to jot in the margins. It reduces confusion around words like headshot, somebody's picture, and prevents people from thinking the word head needs to be added to the text. A subhead also uses the H-E-D spelling, and that's a mini headline in the middle of a story dividing it into sections.
Oh.
My understanding is that we have a transatlantic difference with the deck. D-E-K is how you'd spell that, though you see it both ways. A deck is the line or block of text below a headline, which often explains a little bit more about it. And it also ends up sometimes being like your social media copy that appears underneath the headline or gets pulled into other places like a Google search and things like that. It can be like a little short intro in bold or italics before the story gets started. Another one is nut graph. That's the nutshell paragraph. You're familiar with reverse pyramid style. Your lead starts out. I'm going out of order here, but we've got our head, our deck, our lead, and then our nut graph. And your nut graph early in the piece explains the essential point or why of the story after you've done the who, what, when, where. And the nut here is as in the like core essence of the story, and graph is G-R-A-F. Which is a shortening of paragraph. The spelling is shorter just because it's easier to write and because it avoids confusion with things like insert a graph here.
Very good. Isn't it funny how I think journalists are often think of ourselves as protectors of the language? Here they are playing fast and loose with spelling just for their own convenience. Makes sense though. It's pragmatic.
TK is also one you'll see a lot. If you've ever seen a public or if you've ever seen a story go live online with TK in the headline, it's because somebody wrote that story ahead of time and forgot to go in and fill it in. It is short for to come, but TC is more frequently found in words in English, whereas TK is only found in a few common words, unless you're writing about latkes a lot for some reason. It marks a thing you need to fill in later. So if I write an obituary for someone who is not dead yet, but we know that they're going to die sometime soon, then we can pre-write the story about them, but we can say in the headline, so-and-so is dead at TK, and that's where you put the age at which they died for TK reason. And you can easily control find and locate your TKs,
right,
fill them in. But you may have seen them go live before by accident.
Ooh. With the, comments.
By the way, have you ever thought through why we call text copy? It's pretty simple. Words submitted for publication and now in digital formats are called copy because it meant something that's reproduced widely as news. You would make a lot of copies. It would appear in lots of places, lots of copies of that paper. Every sense of the word copy is from the Latin copia, meaning abundance, which means it's also related to the word cornucopia.
Oh, copious. Okay, uh-huh. Nice.
And your copy editor goes through and makes sure that the copy is clean and aligned with house style. They traditionally sat at the copy desk and you'd file your copy to them for copy editing. And today, copywriters develop copy, typically for marketing purposes. And the reason we call it that in that instance is because those words are meant to be used in affiliation with the brand across many different media. Your marketing copy will be used on your website and might be used on your social media account and might be adapted for whatever else, but it's approved by the brand, perhaps developed by the ad agency.
Are you aware of Bettridge's law, Jess?
No, tell me.
Ian Bettridge was and still is a journalist, a British journalist. And in 2009, he said that any headline that ends in a question mark can be answered by the word no. Have you heard this?
Now that you mention this, I do remember discussing this before, but I would love to hear more. Give me some examples.
So the reasoning is that if a journalist could stand up the statement, it would be a statement. They can't stand it up. They put it as a rhetorical question. Right. Ian Bettridge, he quoted this law that now has his name. It was sort of a received wisdom as far as he was concerned. In an article where it was actually just a blog post. He calls it a throwaway blog post that he made back in 2009, like I said. And the headline that he was referring to was, did Last.fm just hand over user listening data to the RIAA? So it's a pretty dull, innocuous sounding headline, particularly if you don't understand what on earth is going on about. But basically, it's quite a big claim by the website TechCrunch about a website potentially sharing the information of its users. But it's been written as a question. And the way that Ian Bettridge criticized this was he said, this story is a great demonstration of my maxim that any headline which ends in a question mark can be answered by the word no. The reason why journalists use that style of headline is that they know the story is probably BS and don't actually have the sources and facts to back it up, but still want to run it.
We see this a lot in commentary too, like op-eds, which, by the way, not opinion, opposite the editorial.
Oh, is it really? It doesn't stand for opinion.
No, it does not. Op-ed means opposite. And the reason for this is you would put your hard news on the front and then opposite it would be a contributor article or something like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. We tend to call them columns a bit more often.
Columns are different in the UK. For me.
Ah, right. Okay, go on.
So an op-ed typically is an opinion, but it's usually by a guest contributor. A column is often by a recurring contributor.
I know what you're getting at. And I think particularly explainers are very common these days. And often they will start with a question, right? And that kind of makes sense if the question that is the headline is the question that is answered. You know, the idea is, oh, this is what the viewer or listener or reader might be thinking. So let's answer that. We're trying to put ourselves in their place. But otherwise, you know, did scientists just find a cure for HIV? Well, if you've written it as a question mark, no, they didn't, right? Because otherwise you say, scientists just found a cure for HIV.
Right.
ABC News one back in, 2011, I guess. Will the world end in 2012?
Right.
The answer, it turned out, was no. Anyway, so Ian Bettridge is still knocking about. So earlier on today, I asked him about his law.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and he was kind enough to reply. I asked him how he felt about, you know, his eponymy for the last, 16 years. And he said, I love the law because if it's improved headline writing even slightly, it will have made the world a better place in a tiny, tiny way. What more could anyone ask? And it has made a difference because I remember when I was at the BBC, someone hammering this very thing into me. Don't use these rhetorical questions because when people hear it, they'll assume the answer is no. But there actually wasn't a US ruling on these sort of questioning headlines back in 1913. The Supreme Court in Oklahoma made a ruling on this, and it said, a man cannot libel another by the publication of language, the meaning and damaging effect of which is clear to all men, and where the identity of the person meant cannot be doubted, and then escape liability through the use of a question mark. And now he's getting to the point of this.
Same idea,
right?
Yeah.
If it's very clear, the assertion you're making, but all you've done is stick a question mark at the end of it, it won't protect you, even in those very permissive laws.
Yeah. It has the same energy as I'm just asking questions, bro.
That's exactly what it is. Just asking questions. Just asking questions. Well, you're making heavy implications and potentially actionable ones.
Bad faith, logical fallacies all over the place.
Yeah, bad faith is the term for it, right? It's bad faith.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
Another really good example of a headline with a question mark at the end of it was the New York World's question mark at the end of its headline, 1918, the morning after the presidential election, where its headline was, Hughes elected in close contest? What a question mark. So all the other papers were reporting that, Charles Evans Hughes had won the election, but the New York World got a tip off that maybe he hadn't. And so they just added this question mark to the end of it. And lo and behold, Woodrow Wilson had won the election, actually. And were the only ones who technically weren't wrong, although they did show a picture underneath the headline of Hughes, and it said, President-elect Hughes. So, they didn't fully get away with it.
Nowadays, we just write both stories for the outcome and then run whichever one it is.
That makes a lot more sense. A lot more fail-safe.
Of course, you can edit online now, so that's a little different.
Yeah, but you still got to get it right before you put the paper to bed?
Precisely.
The term they use for sending it off before it gets printed. There's still, if you, like in Britain, if it's printed down in London, in Wapping or whatever, and it's got to get up to Scotland for the first edition, then you've got to put that to bed good and early. But sometimes you will find, you get a less factual newspaper the further north you go in Britain, because they've had more time to correct it. Which is quite funny.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, you used to have multiple editions during the course of a day. My local newspaper used to have a morning edition and an evening edition. In the end, they got rid of the morning edition and it became the Derby Evening Telegraph. And you only ever publish once a day. And now they're not, well, they are still, but a lot of them aren't publishing any.
Your law reminded me of a few different terms that have come from, that have some kind of fun stories and people behind them. One of them being journalism styles, like yellow journalism, for example, coined in the 1890s during the newspaper circulation wars between Joseph Pulitzer, the New York World, and William Randolph Hearst's New York Journal. So the term, oddly enough, do you know where we got yellow for this one?
No, I don't even know what yellow journalism means.
Oh, okay. It's like sensationalist news. To say something is yellow journalism is to be like, it's similar to tabloidese, but it's not. It's more like it's any kind of sensationalism, and it doesn't have to be in a tabloid, and it's not necessarily qualified by certain phrasing styles. It is named after The Yellow Kid, which is a comic strip. The reason it became emblematic of sensationalism is because Pulitzer's newspapers added this as one of the first adult-focused and entertaining cartoon comic strips that was just there for entertainment and not for like a political cartoon purpose. And it was intended to sell more papers. So like the whole reason it was there is so the Yellow Kid became emblematic of this rivalry, and alongside it, they were also doing other sensationalist, emotionally manipulative things to get people to buy papers. It also probably alludes to, or may have been perpetuated by, notions of yellow as like cowardice and other negative connotations too. Around this era, at the same time, if you said the term yellow dog, you were probably talking about like a street mutt. And so there are certain affiliations with that as well. And that was where we got Yellow Dog Democrat for in the 1800s, when a Southern Democratic voter would vote for a yellow dog before they would vote for a Republican.
Yeah, this reference to the street dog reminds me of the term gutter journalism as well.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Similar idea.
Another one of these, and this one is like a very clear connection to a specific journalist, and I'm sure everyone will know what I'm talking about, but gonzo journalism, made famous by Hunter S. Thompson, specifically his piece, The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, when he went and just talked about this spectators at the Kentucky Derby instead of reporting on the Derby itself. And it's, and gonzo journalism is wild. It's subjective. It's immersive. It's first person. It's sometimes fueled by copious amounts of drugs. It was Bill Cardoso who described Hunter S. Thompson's style in that way.
Do we know where gonzo comes from?
It was probably from Italian slang. The term gonzo was used in like, that's a gonzo something or other. I'm not going to come up with a good example sentence there, but to call someone gonzo was to call them rude in a loud or obnoxious way. But it might also have been and was used prior in jazz slang to describe music that's raucous and passionate. So all kinds of fun stuff. And I love the notion of Hunter chasing a story like a trumpeter or something. The Italian term might come from a word for a goose too.
Oh yeah.
Because of the way that they trumpet.
Oh, that's interesting. For a goose. Yeah. I'm just thinking about Germanic words for goose are quite similar to the word gonzo.
And they are similarly cantankerous, right?
Sorry, impromptu goose impression.
That was pretty good.
Embarrassing.
By the way, the Muppet character Gonzo debuted in 1970, which was 1 year before Gonzo Journalism was named, but he wasn't given the name Gonzo until after it was applied to the journalistic style. So it's probably an intentional connection there.
I've got a knobbly monster of one of Gonzo's friends, Kermit T. Frog, being referred to as the famed amphibian.
I love it. I love it. The bard of rainbow connections. Love it. Fabulous. Another one of these, muckraking, coined pejoratively by Theodore Roosevelt in 1906, the man with the muck rake. It's an allusion to Pilgrim's Progress, apparently. The notion here is a journalist who can only see negativity, but this was adopted with pride by early 20th century investigative journalists who exposed corporate and political corruption, including Ida Tarbell, Upton Sinclair, and Lincoln Steffens.
So what about Pilgrim's Progress? Is he referencing that?
The man with the muckrake in Pilgrim's Progress can look no way but downward with the muckrake in his hand.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So like all he sees is filth.
Oh, that's elegant.
Uh-huh.
Looking no way but downward. As we draw this podcast to an end, Jess, I am reminded of one of the first bits of advice I was given when I started working in journalism. It was because I had made a report that I had ended in a very cliched way.
Oh.
So, you know, when you do a report or any news story, you try to sort of create some sort of narrative arc with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Sometimes it's a bit of a chore.
Yeah. And you're usually supposed to look to the future at the end, and you can't. So it's very tempting to just write, "And only time will tell," which is exactly what I did in my very first report. And a very polite colleague said, this is very good, but dare write that ever again.
Take that red pen right to that sentence.
Will we return for another episode of Words Unraveled? Only time will tell. Yes. Almost certainly. God willing. But I've enjoyed this one, Jess.
Oh, yeah, that was a very nice kicker on this this tale. Thank you all for tuning in to another Words Unraveled. We'll see you next time.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.